Good afternoon, America. Welcome to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop on Washington, bringing you all the news from the nation's capital that the government does not want you to know. Today, like yesterday, we are out of studio. We are reporting in Washington, D.C., but not in the studio. We're in the Hilton at the conference to Take Back America, put on by the Campaign for America's Future, the largest gathering, indeed, of progressives, really since the Democratic National Convention. Well, some people think those people weren't progressive enough. I don't know, but we got a terrific slate of guests today, and your chance to call in and talk to really some leaders, some progressive leaders in the Democratic Party, people who are thinkers and forward-thinking about where our party should go in the future, where progressives should go in the future. My first guest is going to be Gar Alperovitz. He's the author of a book called Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. And I, for one, would like to know how we can reclaim these things, because I see them as pretty far gone. It's going to be a pretty long road to go ahead. I'm going to ask him some tough questions on that. Then we've got Luis Navarro. He's the former political director for the John Kerry for President campaign. And I plan to ask him some pretty tough questions, too, as you can imagine. Then I've got Chuck Panaccia. This is an interesting guy. He's the Democratic candidate for the United States Senator from Pennsylvania. Now, this is really a tough question, because he's running against Bob Casey. Bob Casey is a pro-life Democrat. He's kind of a centrist Democrat. And, of course, they're running against the devil incarnate, Rick Santorum. Now, like any good Democrat, I want to see Rick Santorum kicked out of office. And on the other hand, my heart is with a progressive like Chuck Panaccia. Now, I'm not in Pennsylvania. I don't have to make this decision. But the heart of the question, do we go with our heart, the progressive, Chuck Panaccia, who we agree with, or do we go with maybe our brain and say, maybe Bob Casey can beat Rick Santorum better? That's a tough question. It doesn't just affect Pennsylvania. It's a broader question for anyone who believes in the Democratic Party, who believes in progressive principles. He's going to be a great guest. And then concluding, I've got Paul Waldman, senior fellow with Media Matters. These are the people who watch the right-wing media, the things that you and I don't like to watch, the Fox Propaganda Channel, Rush Limbaugh, Gasbag, all that stuff, to find out all the lies they're saying and report on them. He's going to be a great guest, too. So we've got a terrific lineup for you. And if you want to call in and ask questions of these very distinguished guests, it's easy to do. Just pick up the phone and dial toll-free, 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. The phones are a little weird here because we're sort of jerry-rigged up on a system. So if that line is busy, I want you to call a local number. Sorry, usually it's toll-free. But if that line's busy, try the local number, 202-387-1821. And we'll get in your calls. Of course, you're always welcome to comment on the blog at radioinsidescoop.com. Let me introduce my first guest. His name is Gar Alperovitz. Gar, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thanks.
Now, are you a professor? Do I call you Professor Alperovitz or just Gar?
You can call me Gar, but I am a professor.
Okay. And you're a professor of political economy, which is interesting to me because I, you know, was an economics major in school, and I certainly have an interest in politics. Now, let me go through the economy in America as I see it, and you tell me where I'm wrong or where I'm right. I see the greatest difference between rich and poor in probably since the Great Depression. Is that fair?
Absolutely, and longer than that, since the 20s at least.
Since the 1920s.
The top 1% has more income now than the bottom 100 million people taken together. It's an awesome number.
The top 1%, so that's what, 3 million people?
A little bit less.
Okay, a little bit less than 3 million Americans have more wealth.
More income.
More income than the 100 million at the lowest levels. That's more income. How about wealth?
Wealth is extraordinary. The top 1% of wealth holders has almost 50% of the investment and business capital. Almost 50%.
Half of everything you can own in America.
No, investment capital.
Okay, so that doesn't include
real estate. If you
throw
in the houses and real estates, it's about 40%.
40%.
But who owns America's business? The top 1% has 48% of the stock and bonds and business investment. It's extraordinary. Medieval.
And it's fair to say that it's worse now than it's been since the
1920s. Absolutely. Let me give you one other number.
Sure.
This is all from the book America Beyond Capitalism.
Right.
The top two-tenths of 1%, two-tenths of 1%, way up there, tiny, tiny, tiny group, made more money on the sale of stocks and bonds in the most recent data we have from the government than everyone else in the entire society taken together. Top two-tenths of 1%.
Wait, greater than the other 99.8%?
That's absolutely right. They made more money on the sale of stocks and bonds than the other society, everyone else in the society taken together. Extraordinary number.
Everyone else selling stocks and bonds.
Yes.
Okay. So
right,
in the
most
sale
people
of,
don't have it much.
Right. So in the sale of stocks and bonds, and remember, you know, our president wants to put all our Social Security, of course, in the stock market. You're telling me the top 2%, the 0.2%, 0.2%.
That's right.
Two out of 1,000
yep,
people.
You got it.
Made more money selling stocks and bonds than the other 99.8% put together.
Put together. It's an extraordinary number.
Okay.
I mean, the concentrations of income and wealth, just as you said, are getting worse and worse. But what people need to gather, this is almost a medieval society in the terms of wealth and income. Very, very, very extreme concentrations that people haven't quite grasped yet. And that's one place to start the discussion.
Okay, well, and I'm going to get there. Let me just lay out the problems here because they're enormous. Energy. We're running out of oil. We're running out of fossil fuels. And maybe you can give me some good statistics on how much energy Americans use versus the rest of the world. Tell me about the energy crisis.
Well, I'm not an energy specialist, but okay. We're about 5% of the population, and we use about 25% of the energy. So, I mean, it's, again, five times our weight in energy, if you like.
Energy crisis. Corporate excess. How much is a CEO corporations taking versus your average person?
Well, let me give you a number on that. I've been watching long trends because I think it's the only way to get at this. And I think there's going to be a backlash that's going to lay the groundwork for something new. The corporate taxes used to be in about the late 1940s, just after the war, 31% of the federal taxes. They are now down to about 7%. Corporation taxes have gone from 31 to 7%.
Now, you're talking about the total tax revenue the government takes
yes,
in?
Yes, that's right.
So, okay, so it used to be, after World War II, about a third of government revenue was
under.
Derived, a little under, 31%,
yes.
Was derived from corporations.
That's right.
And now you're telling me 7% is
7.3,
derived from corporations.
Yes.
7.3%. So from a little under a third to less than one-tenth.
That's right.
Amazing. Okay, now.
So that's the trend, and that's the trend we're seeing in wealth and corporate taxes.
Now, here's the question. Here's the heart. Here's the problem. All right, here's where I'm really going to be tough on you. And it's all, by the way, Gar Alperovitz's book. It's a fascinating book. And actually, on the front cover, you got, looks like a poor guy pulling a bunch of shopping carts because it tells you where we're going in America. It's called America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. Democracy's in red, which is good because that's the thing I'm most concerned about, though. You know, wealth and liberty, I'm concerned about that too. All right. What it says on the back of your book, and this is the thing that I find really difficult. You and I agree on the problem. In fact, you have a lot more statistics than I do, but the kind of things you're talking about, disparity in wealth, energy crisis, corporations having more and more control, these are things I talk about on my show all the time. My listeners can attest to that. But what the book says is that you've got solutions to a lot of these problems, and that's what I want to hear. Start wherever you
okay,
like.
Okay, well, let me start here. I think things are going to get worse before they get better. That's the starting place. I think the trends that we've begun to describe are extraordinary. But I'm also a historian as well as a political economist. And what you see historically around the world and in the United States as well, as the pain steadily builds up, people get to a certain point and then they get a backlash. I'm from Wisconsin in the 1950s when Joe McCarthy covered everything. You couldn't move politically in Wisconsin. And if you read the tea leaves of the Times in Wisconsin in the 1950s, with Joe McCarthy hanging over your head, you would have said that nothing would ever change. What came next was civil rights, feminism, environmental, anti-war. The whole thing opened up because no one was reading deep enough. Now, I'm not a utopian, but I think the pain is growing and we're going to have a backlash and then we're going to move.
The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP. I only have this terrific professor, Gar Alperovitz, for 15 minutes. You know, maybe I can convince him to come on another show. You and I will have to work on that, listeners. But I only have him for 15 minutes. If you want to call in, please do so. 877-57-SCOOP. 877-57-SCOOP or comment on the blog at radioinsidescoop.com. All right, Gar, tell me, what was it in the 1950s that made people turn off to Joe McCarthy and turn on to civil rights? And the larger question, of course, is where in 2005, 2006, 2007, what will it be where Americans finally say, I've had enough, they're taking my pensions, they're taking Social Security away, and finally come and throw these bums out?
Well, I think that is highly likely because look what just happened in Europe. The French and the Dutch said, no, we're not going to do this, and it's another version of that. But I think it's a little different process. The press doesn't cover this, but at the grassroots level, we are building up, and this is what really interests me and why I called the book America Beyond Capitalism, we are not doing the old liberal kind of try to tax the middle class in order to pay for the central city. I'm for taxing people who can afford to. But I think that way is fading all around the world. But what is happening is wealth ownership is changing. There are 11,000 companies owned substantially or wholly by workers in this country now, and they keep jobs in communities. They change the ownership of wealth. More people involved than there are unions in the private sector. It's a changing wealth pattern. There are 4,000, some people say 6,000, I was recently told 12,000 neighborhood-owned corporations that changed the ownership of this wealth problem to benefit communities. There's one in Newark, New Jersey, makes $50 million a year and pours the money back into community development.
Okay, but Gar, here's my concern, all right? And correct me where I'm wrong, but when you look at the Enron crisis, for example, you had workers thinking they're owning their company, right? They're putting all their pension money into ownership, into stock. I mean, that's supposed to be ownership. They think they're owning the company, and I like the concept of worker-owned corporations. Don't get me wrong. That's exactly where I'd like to go. But these people in Enron were destroyed. How do we have protections so that we have workers who not only own corporations but can't be taken for a ride by malevolent CEOs?
Absolutely right. And indeed, in most of the worker companies, they have a separate pension plan. And then they also have ownership of wealth, which is the way the rich do it. They have their pension in one place, and they have a separate ownership. But ownership of wealth is the key issue, I think, of the 21st century, and we're beginning to see it. Big, big funds, not just little ones. For instance, state ownership, state pension funds are huge funds. That's trillions and trillions of dollars, and they're now beginning to say, let's start using them to develop the jobs in our state, not only liberal states. In Alabama, the pension fund, public capital, public wealth, is being used to create jobs in the state, including a couple hundred worker-owned companies to keep jobs there. This
now,
is
now
the
how
direction.
Does that, how does that work? A state pension fund, of course, that would be for government workers,
teachers
and so forth. They have money put aside for the pension. They have to invest it somewhere.
Absolutely. They invest it anyway.
So your example, what was it, Alabama even?
Alabama included, not
tell
just
what,
liberal
tell
states.
Tell me what happened in Alabama. I mean, that's the reddest of the red states. Tell me how Alabama is providing for its workers, because I find that counterintuitive.
That's what's really interesting. These wealth ownership ideas often transcend, they're very progressive in my view, but they often transcend the usual stereotypes.
What are they doing in Alabama?
In Alabama, the public pension funds, teachers are being used to invest in order to create jobs in the state, including investment in a couple hundred worker-owned companies. And what's interesting about worker-owned companies, not only does it change ownership of wealth, those companies don't get up and run to Mexico because the people live there.
Certainly.
They're more productive.
You can't outsource them, for one thing.
You can't outsource them. They're more productive, all the studies show, and they're much, much more profitable because people, not surprisingly, they have a stake. But it's this idea of wealth, changing the way wealth is owned. And I think what we're doing, there are also municipal corporations are going into business to make money for the cities. That's happening because of the fiscal crisis.
I'd like to get to a listener caller. You're on the air with Mark Levine and Gar Alperovitz. Welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hi, yes, this is Gordon from Michigan.
Hi, Gordon.
Howdy. I'd just like to get a synopsis of what the U.S. Annual budget is, and what percentage of the U.S. annual budget goes to the military-industrial complex, and what percentage of this money that goes to the military-industrial complex is actually legally auditable and practicably auditable?
That's a great question. Gar, can you answer that question?
I can answer part of it, but they keep the second part of the question hard to answer. The current budget is about a little over 4% of the gross domestic product. So that's a very small number in terms, but it's several. It's $400 to $500 billion.
What percentage of our budget, of our government budget?
Of the government budget.
Yes,
of the government budget, it is about 4/20. One-fifth or so.
Okay, so one-fifth of the government budget, which is how many billions of dollars?
About 450 now.
$450 billion goes to the military-industrial complex, the military and also all the weapons and so forth to make the military. And how much of it can we actually audit?
Well, in theory, you can audit it all. In theory. But indeed, look what's happening out in the war in Iraq. They're making deals so fast that you can't follow the paper trail at all.
Who's supposed to audit this? Supposed to watch this?
There is internal auditing within the government, within the Defense Department, within the Pentagon. There's external auditing in the Congressional Services, the GAO, which is an agency of the Congress, is supposed to overlook this. There's internal inspectors. But the question is whether or not they're getting some of this, and a lot of it just passes by.
I mean, Halliburton, apparently they lost $8.8 billion that they still can't find.
Yeah, it's...
So who's laying down on the job? Is it the administration? Is it Congress? Is it both of them?
All of them. All of them are laying down on the job, and they don't want to find out this because it demonstrates how poorly the whole thing's administered. They prefer not to find out.
Gordon, you got another question?
I'm just wondering, you said this money is auditable, but it isn't audited. Is this a sort of a practice that is like turning the other way, or is this illegality?
That's a great question. I mean, are people just, are they doing a lousy job, or are they purposefully refusing to audit these things because, after all, these people are contributors to campaigns and
so
on? Well,
no, they do. These are audited.
Where are those audits,
but
Gar?
The question is, anybody who's done, you know, numbers don't lie, but liars number.
Statistics,
something like that.
Figures don't lie, but liars figure.
That's the expression. So people do audit, but what they have time to audit, what they claim they have time, how much energy and resources they have, they miss an awful lot, and some of it may very well be they don't want to.
Is this different from the past? I mean, in the Clinton era, were there better audits, or is this something where our government, I mean, Eisenhower warned us about the military-industrial complex. Is this something that we're always here with, or is it worse
now? Well, I think in the Iraq situation, it was so poorly planned and so poorly executed that I think it's much worse than it's ever been. Maybe back in the Civil War it was worse, but in modern times there's been better auditing systems, and now the planning is just outrageous.
Gordon, I'm about done with this guest. Do you want to hang on for the next one, or are you done with your call?
Okay, yeah.
All right, hang on for the next one. I want to ask him another question, and this is from the weblog. It's Michelle from California. And I think she's got a really good point. She says, ask your guest, how do you think you can get readers that really need to understand the topics in your book to understand it? For example, she writes, talk to a small business owner. They think the administration is just great for them. Tell me two things. One, is that small business owner right? The administration is just great for them. Two, I guess three things. Two, if they're wrong, okay, you know, why they think the way they are. And three, how we reach them.
Well, it isn't. There are two things. Three things.
Right.
One, no, it is not true that this administration has been good for small business. They've been big small business failures because the local economies are in trouble, and many small businessmen serve the local economy. They do like the rhetoric of the right-wing politicians, some of them, but not all of them. For example, if you begin to give jobs to workers in a community in Ohio or in Michigan or in California that keep more jobs in the city, worker-owned companies are one example, many others, what happens, they buy the products of the small businessmen. So stabilizing the local economy is good for the small businessman. It may not be good for the corporation who wants to run off to China or Hawaii or Mexico or Alabama, but if you look at it from the point of view of the community, there's a lot in it for beyond left and right.
Okay, but Michelle, I understand your point, and you make a good point. Now, Michelle's second and third questions. All right, assuming you're right, and you sound right to me, that it's not good for the small business owner, why does a small business owner still think it's good for them? Why do they think wrongly, in other words, and how can we get them to understand the truth?
Well, I think we have to go speak to them about these new programs, and I think they haven't been spoken to.
New programs like the pensions that are investing
in
workers.
Yes, and like, there are, for instance, these programs for worker ownership, typically a small businessman sells to his employees a great tax benefits. Hardly anybody knows about this because the press doesn't cover it. There are great benefits and new policies at the state level helping in Ohio and Vermont that could really make this grow. And it's a very positive program, very inexpensive, and it changes who owns wealth. America beyond capitalism.
So at the end of the day, this is great because it all comes down with promoting liberal media, which is always my goal. At the end of the day, what we really need is a better media to cover these issues that the mainstream media isn't. Is that right?
Let's hear it for Mark.
All right. See, you know, I ended up with promotion for my show.
Can I give you a website?
Alperovitz, please, give us your website.
Okay, www.americabeyondcapitalism.com.
www.americabeyondcapitalism.com. Gar Alperovitz, you've been a terrific guest. Thank you very much for coming here on The Inside Scoop. Coming up next is Luis Navarro, the former political director for the John Kerry for President campaign. If you want to call in, the toll-free line is busy now. Gordon's taking it up, but you can dial locally 202-387-1873, 202-387-1873, and we'll be right back with the next guest here from the Campaign for America's Future right after these messages.
Tom DeLay is powerful, so why is he such a crybaby? I'll tell you today on Hightower Radio. Poor old Tom DeLay. Well, he's not really poor, but Tom is feeling poorly these days. DeLay is an enormously powerful politico. He's the de facto boss of Congress, controls tens of millions of dollars to advance his far right-wing political agenda, directs hordes of corporate lobbyists, and is the legislative point man for the rich leaders of the Christian extremist movement. Yet, powerful as he is, Tom says that he's really a martyr, a victim of a vast liberal conspiracy that's out to get him because he's a Christian visionary sent by God to set America right. As he recently blathered to a right-wing group, this is exactly the issue that's going on in America, attacks against the conservative movement, against me. That whole syndicate that they have going on right now is for one purpose and one purpose only, and that's to destroy the conservative movement. I mean, this is a huge nationwide concerted effort to destroy everything we believe in. What a solipsistic whiner. DeLay is renowned as a vindictive, vituperative, nasty, brutish political boss, but now we learn that he's also a pathetic crybaby. What has him crying is the fact that he's been caught in one case after another of political corruption and rank hypocrisy, so he's now wallowing in martyrdom, flailing at unseen enemies who, he insists, have nothing more important to do on earth than to try to get poor old Tom. The only one getting Tom, of course, is Tom. He laundered corrupt corporate money into Texas to rig congressional election districts to enhance his own political power. He has taken money in exchange for legislative favors, junketeered on the money of foreign agents, attempted to bribe another member of Congress, and canned the Republican chairman of the Ethics Committee, who had the audacity to reprimand him 3 times in the past year. This is Jim Hightower saying, to help oust this whimpering autocratic thug, go to www.ourfuture.org. Support for this program comes from the Progressive Magazine, featuring columnists Miley Ivins, Howard Zinn, and Barbara Ehrenreich, with features and information available at progressive.org.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, former congressional attorney Mark Levine, bringing you all the news from Washington the government does not want you to know. We're in a hectic environment here at the Campaign for America's Future. Do I have another guest coming? In 2 minutes, I have another guest coming, but for now, we're still with Garal Purovitz. I think he's terrific. Frankly, like I said, I want to get him on for a whole show. Can I get you for that?
Absolutely,
sometime in the future?
Sure.
Terrific.
Delighted to.
Because we can really go into some of these things, statistics in detail.
Right.
Let me ask you just one more question, then my next guest is coming up here. And this is a question from Michelle in California, and she says, you know, that's good for Alabama, but here you have a blue state, a liberal state like California, and she writes, everything's going on in here in California are attacks on public programs, state pension funds, privatizing schools, workman's comp, getting rid of union rights. I mean, it's not all going in this good direction.
No, I think in many ways things are going to get worse before they get better, but in California, Schwarzenegger did not win on the pension fight. He backed off of it, and he's nervous on that. And interestingly enough, here's another thing going on around the country. California passed a tax on people making over $1 million and used that money this past year to help mental health programs. That's happening also in other states. Over $500,000 in New Jersey using that tax to offset real estate. That's going after those people at the very top. Not just ownership we should change, but also beginning to tax in a populist form.
Let me ask you this, I'm the first to agree. We need more progressive media. As you know, I hit that drumbeat all the time. But for Michelle in California,
right.
She's sitting there, and she's talking with a friend who has a small business, I don't know, grocery store, something like that. What can she tell that person in an easily understandable way, not a bunch of statistics, but a friend of hers who may be a moderate, considering voting Republican, say, I don't like all these high taxes. Give me, if you can, a one-minute pitch that my friend Michelle, listening to me right now on the air, can tell her friend with a small business on why this is not the administration for her. She needs to vote for the Democratic Party.
Oh, it's obvious. This administration is giving away millions and billions to the top 1% to 2%. Your kids can't get into college. Your tuition's going off the top. The people without health care. The taxes at your local level are going to be strangling the local government. The garbage is piling up on the streets. The things that are happening locally and in the state are trickled down from the throwaway and giveaway at the administration at the top. So that's a negative, and it's time to move those folks out. But the Democrats have to begin moving forward in a new direction to begin owning and showing people there's another direction. And that's why I wrote this book, and I hope you'll read it.
It is a terrific book, America Beyond Capitalism. It's not too thick for those of you that are afraid of these things. And I got to tell you, this is an economist who can take his statistics and put it down in easily understandable ways. I highly recommend this book, America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaim Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. The author is Gar, G-A-R, Alperovitz, A-L-P-E-R-O-V-I-T-Z. And the website, Gar?
www.americabeyondcapitalism.com.
www.americabeyondcapitalism.com. Gar, thank you very much for appearing on the Inside Scoop. My next guest is going to be Luis Navarro. He's the former political director for the John Kerry for President campaign, and I'm going to ask him some tough questions. If you want to call in, the toll-free number is busy. I'm going to get back to Gordon. He's using my line for the moment. We'll get back to him in a second, but you can dial locally 202-387-1873 or 202-387-1821. I'm going to go right now, right away, to my next guest. It is Luis Navarro. Luis, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you having me.
Well, I appreciate your being on, but I got to tell you something. You know, former political director for the John Kerry campaign, a lot of progressives aren't too happy with you folks right now, Luis. Now, I don't mean to, you know, I write you on my show. You're really nice. You appear in everything. But I got to tell you, I know you know. What people are saying in their kitchens, you know, maybe not to their Republican friends, but when we Democrats talk to each other, we're saying, how could you not beat the most lying, corrupt, incompetent president since Richard Nixon, maybe even worse? Luis, what went wrong here?
Well,
I know I put you on the spot, but that's what I do.
Hey, you know, I was the political director through the Iowa caucuses, so...
Oh, okay. Is that true?
Yes, indeed.
I can't blame you. You did well through Iowa. Hey, I need to talk to the guy who replaced you. You were great.
But, I was the Western director for ACT through the balance of 2004.
Clearly, for ACT, ACT, yes, America correct. Coming Together, which is a 527 that helped John Kerry.
Indeed.
Well, they did a pretty good job. They got a lot of people out.
Well, we did, but the challenge overall was this. We did not see a compelling narrative on the part of the Kerry campaign. You know, he was never comfortable with the answer around Iraq outside of the debates. I thought he did very well in the debates. I think most of your listeners would agree that he did an excellent job there. But I think the impression overall was that the campaign did not have a coherent answer around either Iraq or why it should replace the Bush administration. And as President Clinton had said at the beginning of the cycle, when given the choice, Americans will choose strong and wrong over weak and right every time, and I think that's what the situation we had.
Okay, now the name of my show is The Inside Scoop.
I give
listeners not just news the government doesn't want you to know. That's what I mostly
do.
But I like to give news about what really goes on in Washington. So, Luis, give me the inside scoop. What happened? These are good people behind the Kerry campaign. Why didn't they have a compelling narrative? Is it, I hate to say this, is it John Kerry? Is it the people working for him? What went wrong, and how will it be different in 2008?
I think three things. First of all, the campaign was not as diverse as it should have been for all the constituencies it was trying to address, specifically. When John Kerry loses 9% of the Hispanics relative to Al Gore's performance in 2000, when he loses 3% among African Americans relative to Al Gore in 2000, you have to ask the question, how does a Democrat lose among historically loyal constituencies?
It's a great question. Now answer it.
It is because it was a campaign that did not reflect the diversity of those constituencies, either in terms of who was making decisions or in how resources were being allocated.
Did we need more Spanish language television commercials?
What you needed was a strategy around how you were going to win Hispanic votes.
And how do we win Hispanic votes?
The way you win Hispanic votes is dealing with them the same way you would any other swing constituency. What this election demonstrated was when George Bush got the highest number of Hispanic votes of any Republican since Reagan's landslide in 84, that was a big warning sign. And the fact is that the Kerry campaign did not take it as a warning sign. It simply assumed that those voters would come back because George Bush was so bad and it was so obvious.
Okay, now, Luis, you and I mean, Democrats were very good at turning the firing squad into the center and shooting at each other. Mm-hmm. Okay, what's past is past.
Sure.
What can we do in the future as a party to reach out to Latinos, to reach out to constituencies, to reach out to everyone, evangelical voters,
three things have to
voters.
Change.
Okay,
three things
you
have
tell
to
me.
Change. Number one, we have to eliminate the culture of transaction in which the Democratic Party and its candidates outsource its responsibility to engage African American Latino voters by paying some arbitrary sum of money to small self-appointed groups of leaders. Secondly, we have to develop a broader base of voter behavior research so that we know what Hispanic voters who are Mexican, who are Puerto Rican, who are Cuban, who are, you know, a variety of communities, what they actually want and think as voters. We don't address them that way. What we say is, oh, those are Hispanics. We treat them as one size fits all.
There's no question. Puerto Ricans, Cubans, Mexicans.
Right, it's all the same to most consultants, right?
No, that's silly.
So then
I agree with you.
And the third thing is that we have to address some of the systemic problems that exist within the party. The primacy of Iowa and New Hampshire provides for a continuing cycle in which white political operatives make all the decisions around voters of, you know, around voters of color, without any frame of reference themselves for their own elections.
Hang on, Luis. Do we have our next guest yet or not? Apparently not yet, so we will keep talking.
Sure.
The numbers to call, and I'm going to get back to Gordon in a minute. He's on my toll-free line.
Sure.
But you can also call 202-387-1873 or 202-387-1821. Let me bring back Gordon from Michigan, a caller. Gordon, do you have a question for this guest, Luis Navarro?
Yeah. In being a progressive myself, I supported John Kerry, but I must also admit he was fuzzy on some progressive issues that we have. I'd be interested in finding out what Luis is, if he could give us a stand on John Kerry's position about the institution of a cabinet-level Department of Peace as instituted by a congressional bill supported by Dennis Kucinich.
I believe that John Kerry took the position that a Department of Peace is an amorphous notion, at least from his perspective, that basically through the State Department and the international aid programs that are executed by the United States, that is basically our opening ante in terms of securing peace around the world.
Well, you know, as progressives would say, there's a big gap in the cabinet, as well shown blatantly by this administration, that there was no answer. When people wanted a pacifist view, a pacifist alternative to going into Iraq, there was nothing to be heard. That probably was because of manipulation of the administration, but progressives believe that there was an alternative voice in the cabinet, a la a Department of Peace, which would also utilize the current structure of the Peace Corps in being an advocate for peace and not necessarily the warring option of the military-industrial complex.
Well, Gordon, I understand your point, but let me point out three things, if I may. Number one, Bob Borisage, who heads up the Campaign for America's Future, which is sponsoring this Take Back America conference himself, said that one of the issues that progressives have to wrestle to the floor is what our response is on the national security concern of voters. That is to say, when they cannot comprehend, based on the misinformation that this administration is spouting on the war on terror, what is the progressive answer beyond we shouldn't be in Iraq? We're in Iraq. We now, you know, the question becomes, you know, how do we extricate ourselves in a fashion that, you know, protects our interests, maintains our moral, regain our moral standing relative to the rest of the world? And the answer can't simply be we need to spend less on defense and we need to develop a Department of Peace.
Okay, but
answer to that is to have an advocacy which would be involved in developing a reconstruction in these areas and making sure that we are not occupiers, but we are in there to reconstruct these damaged areas which we've gone in with the military.
Right. I absolutely agree with you, and I think Colin Powell, frankly, was in agreement with us going into the final decision about the war with Iraq. So, you know, I at least based on what I've read in the publications, and even if you only believe half of them, there was a voice. It was from a significant player within the administration. It was simply that this administration was committed to going to war, and I'm not sure a Department of Peace secretary would have had any better result.
Well, it would have been another voice. It would have been two voices instead of one.
Yeah, Gordon, I think I understand where you are on this, and I don't think a Department of Peace certainly would do any harm, but to me, it depends on who you put there. You put a Secretary of Defense like Don Rumsfeld as the head of the Department of Peace, and what do you get? you get Department of War.
The fox in the hen house would be a problem.
Exactly. So I don't know that structurally. I mean, I have no problem with the Department of Peace, but the real problem, I think we can all three agree, is who is running the place rather than where, you know, whether there's a Department of Peace or Department of War or anything else. Though, you know me, I'm a big fan of the Peace Corps, and anything to approve that is a good thing. Gordon, I got to go to commercial break. I want to thank you very much for your call.
Okay.
All right. We go to commercial break. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more with Luis Navarro and then hopefully move on to Chuck Panaccio, the Democratic candidate for the United States Senator from Pennsylvania. We'll be right back after these commercial messages.
For Anna Briggs, now 94 years young, the ethical treatment of animals has been her life's work. Anna Briggs feels that each dog at the Briggs Animal Adoption Center in Charlestown, West Virginia, from scrubby mutt to sleek purebred, deserves a loving home. All have been spayed or neutered and current with their shots and vaccinations. Plus, the majority of dogs have completed basic obedience training. You can find photos and bios of the dogs at the Briggs Animal Adoption Center website, www.baacs.org. That's baacs.org. You'll be doing something very nice for the pet you adopt, and it doesn't take long for you to discover how much these pets will help you and add to your quality of life. The Briggs Animal Adoption Center is an affiliate of the National Humane Education Society. For more information, call 304-724-6558 or visit their website, www.baacs.org.
Magellan? No. Well, who knows what Magellan did?
Sail around the world.
Right. Now.
Sometimes, a child who doesn't seem interested is really a child with a speech or hearing problem.
Blackbeard? Who said Blackbeard? And what did Blackbeard do? He was a
pirate.
Time and again, it's been shown that a young student's ability to read and learn begins with speech and language and hearing skills.
Jamie, are you with us? Who can tell us?
He wanted to go to India.
Many communication disorders can be detected early and corrected, so learning and literacy skills can develop normally. Make sure your child has the speech, language, and hearing abilities to keep up in class. For more information, visit ASHA.org, a public service message from the American Speech, Language, Hearing Association, and this station.
New route to
Asia!
Good!
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, former congressional attorney Mark Levine, giving you all the news from Washington the government does not want you to know. And today we are reporting from Washington, but not in the radio studio. We are in the basement of the Hilton Hotel in Washington, D.C., at the Campaign for America's Future, the Take Back America campaign, the largest gathering of progressives. Well, really, since the Democratic National Convention, and hey, some say those folks weren't progressive enough. If you want to call in, by the way, I already do have a caller on the line. You hang on. The toll-free number today, because of the way these things jerry-rigged here, it only works on one line. So you can still call in, but I'm going to have to encourage you to make a long-distance call, something I never asked you to do before. But if you really want to call in, there are lines open. You just have to dial long-distance, 202-387-1873 or 202-387-1821. And hey, as the toll-free number is used up, you can use that too. 877-57-SCOOP. My next guest is someone who I had a terrific discussion with, frankly, even before this show began. And to me, it's a question about the heart and soul of the Democratic Party. Now, let me give you the situation because I think it's fascinating here. The guy who's my guest, his name is Chuck Panaccio. Now, he's a Democratic candidate for United States Senator from the state of Pennsylvania. Now, who is, of course, the current senator that he wants to take his seat from? Rick Santorum. Now, I don't have to tell you that Rick Santorum personally, he gives me the heebie-jeebies. This is a guy that really scares me. Okay, this is a guy that really believes the government should come in and intervene in your personal life, tell you very private decisions. Frankly, the guy to me is very close to theocracy. I mean, it's as close to the Taliban as we have in America. Very, very scary guy. Any liberal, any moderate, frankly, should want this guy out of office. Now, there are two candidates running against Rick Santorum. Okay, one of them is a guy named Bob Casey. He's a Democrat. He's kind of a centrist Democrat. He's pro-life on a number of issues. I'll let Bob, I'll let Chuck Panaccia tell you more about Bob Casey. But he's sort of a centrist Democrat. And then we've got Chuck Panaccio, my guest today, and he's a good progressive. He agrees with me probably 98% of the case. And the heart of the question, and to me this is like one of those exam questions where you pose a hypothetical. The heart of the question is, do you, if you're a good liberal Democrat, do you vote your heart with someone like Chuck Panaccio, who agrees with you 95% of the time, but you fear that he could lose to a demon like Rick Santorum? Or do you vote for Bob Casey, a guy who's kind of a weak-kneed Democrat, one of those sort of Republican lights, but a guy who would provide some Democratic votes and a guy who would be infinitely better than Rick Santorum? That's the question. If you want to call in, I still have one line open, 202-387-1873. And if that doesn't work, 202-387-1821. Let me first introduce my guest, Chuck Panaccio. Chuck, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thanks so much, Mark.
Now, to me, this is the great existential Democratic question. Vote your heart or vote your mind, or maybe you can convince me why the mind is wrong, because if I were in Pennsylvania, I'd want to vote for you. It would hurt to pull the lever for Bob Casey, and yet I might do it to get rid of sick Rick Santorum. Tell me why I'm wrong.
Well, you have every opportunity to pull the lever should Bob Casey Jr. win the primary, because I'll support him should he win the primary. I intend to do whatever it takes to bring down Rick Santorum. I'm in this race for entirely positive reasons. And my candidacy in the primary is one that speaks to, as we talked earlier, speaks to the future of the Democratic Party, speaks to the future of our nation, speaks to our core values and principles that bind us together as a nation. So my candidacy, I would argue, and do argue, is in fact the most electable candidacy when it comes to a head-to-head with Rick Santorum, because my candidacy represents a clear contrast on the issues, and my positions on the issues, in fact, represent public opinion, represent the views of the vast majority of Pennsylvanians across
Pennsylvanians,
the board.
Not just Americans.
Pennsylvanians,
I said Maryland, you know, California, Massachusetts, I'd pull the lever for you. But
sure.
Pennsylvania is one of those swing states that always scares me. It might go either way. Why would Pennsylvanians vote for you over Rick Santorum?
Because I speak to their values, I speak to their interests, I speak to their economic concerns. Really, the state of Pennsylvania is in a state of marginal economic depression. It's a state that has far higher proportion of layoffs. It's a state that is suffering more economically than any other middle Atlantic state. It's a state that is losing industries. It's losing tourism. Towns are literally vanishing across the middle of the state. A city like Pittsburgh has shrunk back from a population of 600,000 10 years ago to 300,000 today. It's a state that economically is suffering and suffering badly. And so long as I'm able to keep the question on economic issues and what I can do for Pennsylvanians, I win.
Okay, well, now let me show you something. I got my board lit up here. Literally every single line that
terrific.
I can have is here. So I'm going to get right to my callers.
Please.
Take it away. Caller, you're on the Inside Scoop.
This is Mike from Fairfax.
Hello, Mike from Fairfax.
For Chuck, I recognize the United States does not need two Republican parties. However, you run the risk of claiming that there's no difference between a pro-life Bob Casey and a pro-life Rick Santorum. However, that's the same argument Ralph Nader claimed, and I strongly feel Nader cost us the 2000 election, ignoring Supreme Court. Does your Quit Exotic campaign weaken the Democratic, a thrice elected Democrat in Bob Casey, who got 61% of the vote in 2004?
That's a pretty strong point. Go ahead, Chuck.
You make good points, except I have a problem with the framing of Quixotic, as well as some of the characterizations that Mark used earlier. My candidacy is very serious. This is not a statement candidacy. To take on the Ralph Nader question, Ralph Nader, of course, ran in the general election. I'm not going to run as a third-party candidate, so let's dismiss that right off the top, please.
But it takes away resources from Bob Casey to get ready for a general election.
Well, Mike, that's not fair. Now, wait a minute. We've always had Democratic primaries where Democrats run against each other. I mean, Howard Dean and John Edwards and all ran against John Kerry. You can't say we shouldn't have a primary fight. I mean, we can disagree over who can best beat Rick Santorum. That's why I'm happy I have Chuck on the show. But it's not fair to say there shouldn't be a primary fight, right?
I wonder if it's not a good use of our resources when you have such a strong candidate, who I happen not to agree with in Bob Casey, because I am pro-choice, but he does represent a very strong candidate, and to put somebody else who's never been elected to public office, is that really a viable alternative to a three-time elected statewide candidate?
All right, listen, my listeners are tough, Chuck.
Sure. No, this is great. I really, really enjoy the feedback that you're giving. Now, Bob Casey, true enough, has been elected Auditor General twice and was elected State Treasurer. These are low-visibility races where name recognition rules the day. The one race where Bob Casey Jr. ran in a high visibility race, and stop and think about this, was in 2002, right. Now keep in mind, on October 1st, 2001, he was ahead in the polls, 44-27, ahead of Rendell. Ed Rendell, the former mayor of Philadelphia, the former DNC chair, and now the governor of Pennsylvania. He lost that race by 12 points. When he actually had to step up to the plate, when he actually had to debate Ed Rendell, when he actually had to step out and campaign in front of the people of Pennsylvania, his support eroded. Now, I'm in this race. If I thought Bob Casey was right on the issues and I thought that he was truly as electable as you say, I would not be in this race. I don't relish this. I have a 6-year-old and an 8-year-old at home. I'd much rather be at their ball games. The reason I'm running in this race is because I feel compelled to be in this race. Consider, too, that the Democrats have lost 14 straight. I'll repeat that. 14 straight full-term U.S. Senate elections. The last time a Democrat won a full-term seat in Pennsylvania was 1962, Joe Clark. The problem with Democrats in Pennsylvania in Senate races is that they don't match, is the Democratic Party of Pennsylvania does not know how to win Senate races. Final point, I have been an integral part of three winning U.S. Senate campaigns. I'm a native of Pennsylvania. I was born in Delco, Delaware County. I live in Bucks County. I teach in Philadelphia. But I've stepped out and have organized across the country. I was an integral part of the successful Tom Harkin race in 1984 in Iowa. I know what winning looks like, what it tastes like, what it smells like. Tim Wirth in Colorado, Alan Cranston in California, and I ran Paul Simon's presidential campaigns in Iowa and Illinois. I know how to win. And frankly, I'm not convinced the Democrats of Pennsylvania do.
Mike, thank you very much for your call. I got a full board. I got to go to another caller, but
I really do
appreciate your call.
Thank you, Mike.
Let me go to another caller. Caller, you're on the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine and Chuck Panaccio.
Well, Mark and Chuck, you got Dave from California.
Hi, Dave. How are you?
Really great.
Hey, Dave.
Chuck, if I could say this, I would take quite a different view than the previous caller, because I feel if you are the kind of Democrat that cares about the working class people, if you care about trying to protect Social Security.
Absolutely.
And not just sell out to... Where the Democratic Party is failing, I am convinced of this, is that the neocons have taken over the mechanics of the election.
Yes.
They are controlling voting machines and vote counting machines, and they won't give it up. They had them specially designed. I believe Gore won. I believe Kerry won, and they won big time. But just the mechanics of the election had destroyed it for them. And that has to be our top priority right now.
Well, what can we do about voting machines in Pennsylvania and nationwide? What can you do? What can listeners do to help have at least a fairer vote?
Absolutely.
I am honestly at a point of wanting to deal with them with sledgehammers.
let me answer the question about voting machines, because I'd rather do that than sledgehammers. Go ahead, Chuck.
Yeah, this really is a federal problem. We need to create federal standards, national standards, so that every vote in fact counts, that there's a paper ballot backing it up, so that we can verify voter outcomes. And frankly, I would take it much further. I would make same-day registration. I would create national holidays for voting. If we truly are a democracy, we've got to step up and actually live up to that. Stop paying lip service to democratic ideas and values. Stop trying to stand up to the world and tell them how to conduct their democratic affairs, as the Bush administration has been doing, telling national leaders across the world that you need to hold fair votes. We need to have fair votes in this country. We need to count every vote. We need to make it accessible. We need to emphasize education. Black precincts with two voting booths and white precincts with 10 voting booths, that's an atrocity. It's a national atrocity. It's an immoral performance as far as democracy is concerned. So I think it is actually a federal issue. We can standardize it.
Dave, thank you very much for your call.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dave.
Let me ask you this on voting machines. Now, I know it is. I would like to see federal standards, too. But, of course, we got a federal government controlled by the right wing. In Pennsylvania, you've got a Democratic governor. I don't know your House and Senate. Are they Republican?
Very Republican.
Very Republican. Okay. There are things, obviously, you could do at the local level. You do have a governor who could take a stand and say, we need, in Pennsylvania at least, to have solid, fair voting machines. Has Governor Rendell done this?
He's not done nearly enough as far as pro-democracy reform is concerned. And it really takes an effort to step out and to educate the citizens of Pennsylvania as to what's really at stake here. Because people do not have confidence that their vote is even going to count, let alone count in a meaningful way.
Let me ask you one last question, and then I do have another guest, and I'd like to have you on for a full hour, frankly, in the future, because this is a broader question than just your race. But I have a listener, and she's probably listening right now. She's a frequent listener. Her name is Vicky. You know who you are, Vicky. She's a fundamentalist, evangelical Christian, believes the earth was created in 6 days, and her big issue is abortion. She can agree with the Democrats on environmental policy, on education, on Social Security. She's a fairly reasonable person, I think, on these issues. But she's someone, and I, you know, you're great, Vicky. I don't mean to knock you, but you have posted on my blog more things on abortion than every single other issue put together. This is something that really concerns her. Now, Bob Casey is pro-life.
Right.
You're pro-choice. Rick Santorum is pro-life. Maybe we could get a Vicky, maybe, I don't know, to vote for a Democrat. She's not in Pennsylvania, she's in New York, but you get the point.
Right.
Maybe we could get her to vote for a Bob Casey, a pro-life Democrat, over a pro-life Republican, although I'd rather have you than either of those guys. What do you say when I, you know, to someone like Vicky?
Sure. Well, first of all, you may be right that you can win over a few Vickys, but you're going to lose thousands and thousands and thousands pro-choice voters, because in 2000, a social conservative, Ron Klink, ran against Rick Santorum and lost by over 7 points. So we've seen this scenario. We've seen this train wreck before. We have to stop burying our heads into the sand and realize that unless we create a contrast, we will lose this race. As far as addressing the abortion issue, there are ways of reducing the abortion rate, and for people who can find common ground, and I talk to young Republicans, I talk to middle-aged Republicans, older Republicans, is that there are ways of doing that by creating economic opportunity, by creating an environment in which women feel absolutely secure about bringing their children into the world. The choice of abortion is a painful individual decision, and women often feel that they're backed into a corner when they ultimately make that decision. We as a society need to create a nurturing environment, an open environment, a positive environment for women to bring children into the world. That's how you win voters in the middle. And if I could just do our website.
Sure, please.
For people who want to come check out our campaign.
Please do.
It's Chuck2006.com.
Chuck2006. Chuck2006.com.
Right.
Chuck Panaccio, I really enjoyed this discussion.
Sure.
We're going to have a future discussion on the Inside Scoop in the future.
Okay.
Thank you very much for coming on the show.
I'll hold you to it, Mark.
All right.
Thanks so much.
No, I mean it. Thanks very much. We're going to go to our last guest. His name is Paul Waldman. He is the senior fellow at Media Matters. Now, these are the people who watch the right wing. They're the people who keep the right wing on their toes. They actually listen to Rush Limbaugh. They actually listen to the Fox propaganda channel. Frankly, I don't know that I could stomach it. Without vomiting. But they actually listen to them, and they hold them to the fire. I have used Media Matters, I have to admit, many times on my show. You give great resources, and I want to give you folks a chance in the last few minutes we have remaining to talk to Paul Waldman, the senior fellow at Media Matters, and ask him your tough questions. The toll-free number is open again. It is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. If that is busy, you can try a local number, 202-387-1873. Paul, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, you know, as I said, I am someone who has used Media Matters all the time. Tell me this. You write, and I see your emails, and you talk about all the things the right wing is lying and giving all these things. But with me, you're speaking to the converted. Okay, what are you doing as an organization to actually change the media, to actually get mainstream media, CNN or someone else, to say Rush Limbaugh told a falsehood? Are you actually changing these things, or are you just talking to the converted?
It's a very good question, and although it's certainly important to get people involved and interested, that's one of our goals. We look at the right-wing media as kind of an integrated chain. Now, when they're really successful, they manage to take what Rush Limbaugh says and push it into the mainstream media. That's one of the ways that they exert power. It's one thing if Rush Limbaugh tells his ditto head listeners something and they believe it. Does that really change things? Probably not, because they're all there. They're the converted on that side already. But they really manage to achieve power when they can create such a din that the things that they're saying push their way into television news, into newspapers, and journalists end up accepting them.
We saw, like, with the Swift Boat liars, that was something that was incredibly wild, that this hero, John Kerry, somehow didn't deserve his medals. I mean, if someone said that, you'd think they were an alien 2 years ago, and yet that got into the mainstream media.
Exactly, and one of the problems with that was that eventually reporters got around to figuring out what the truth was, and a couple of newspapers like the Washington Post and the New York Times ran very good investigative pieces that debunked everything that the Swift Boat veterans were saying. The problem was that by the time those newspapers got around to doing that, it had been out there for weeks and it had had its effect. So one of the things we at Media Matters for America try to do is to kind of interrupt that chain. Before journalists start taking those things seriously, we look at them, we analyze them, and we correct that misinformation. So we're trying to be a resource not only for people on the left, but also for reporters. We have a research staff. We don't do editorializing. We don't do, we're not out there just stating opinions. When we see something every day, we monitor the right-wing media and we look at what they're saying. And when we see something they're saying that's false, we're going to document it, do the research, figure out whether it's true, and say that. And hopefully, when we're successful, reporters will take what we say and say, okay, I'm not going to pass these things on that Rush Limbaugh is saying or Bill O'Reilly is saying onto my readers, my viewers, my listeners, because they're not true. And so that's one of the ways we try to have an effect.
I want to get to the phones. The toll-free number is open. It is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. There's still a little bit of time left, and I probably will go over on the Internet, which I sometimes do. If you want to write in on the blog, go to RadioInsideScoop.com. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine and Paul Waldman.
Oh, my gosh, Mark, I wanted to talk to Paul.
Well, then, you got Paul. Is this Michelle from California?
It's Michelle.
Terrific. You got the guest you wanted. Go right ahead.
Paul, I've got to ask you. I mean, I love Media Matters. I really do. I get my information there. The problem that I see is that we have a nation that is fed information via the TV and via the radio. Where is it that you all can support projects such as, like, I know of a project out here in California. It's called Running with Arnold. It's a documentary being done by Dan Cox. I would like to see more information out on those, like, privately interest such media. Like, Mark. Here's Mark. He's on AM, and he's getting out there, but we've got to get these people out there to feed to those people that don't have time to go and read on Media Matters. Do you understand?
You're absolutely right.
I think your question is how do we expand the people who can read, like, Media Matters? And I mean, Michelle, you're talking about just general progressive media. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
And Michelle makes a very good point that, it's one of the kind of ironies of what has happened in recent years is that at the same time as we've seen consolidation of media, that companies like Clear Channel have scooped up lots and lots of radio stations, more media consolidation in the television industry, as that's been happening, there's also been this explosion of sources, particularly on the Internet. The problem that Michelle points to, which is an acute one, is that most people don't go to websites for politics. Most people don't read three newspapers every day. Most people, take in the local news as they're cooking dinner. They catch bits and pieces of it, and unfortunately, when that's what most people are getting, they're more susceptible to propaganda. So part of the thing that you have to do is to look at those sources that have the widest audience, which is your local newspaper, your local news. A lot of people don't know this. Local news is actually the medium that gets that has the most people attuning to it.
Maybe that's surprising to me. You're telling me more people watch the local news than Dan Rather. Well, Dan Rather's gone now, but Tom Brokaw, well, he's gone.
They
now.
Do.
any of the evening news.
They do, and it is surprising to people, but local news has higher ratings than those national news programs, and when you put it all together, and part of the problem, of course, is that in many ways there's no worse source of news than local news. You know, when you strip away the sports and the weather and, you know, squirrels water skiing and whatever they throw in at the end, there's only a few minutes of actual news in there.
Okay, so now how do we get from here to there? Okay, you've made your point. It's a good one. Local news, that gets people out there. Local news, frankly, is also less likely to be ideologically biased, like Clear Channel or Sinclair or any of those. All right, how do we get in the truth? You know, not the liberal truth, but just the facts, the things that you bring out in Media Matters. How can we get that on local news stations around the country?
Well, one of the things to remember is that the closer a news outlet is to you, your local station, your local newspaper, the more likely you as an individual can have an effect on them. So when you call up your local news station, if you see something on there that where they're passing on some piece of misinformation or they're not showing the kind of balance that you think is necessary, call them up, write them a letter. And because they're your local station and they're intensely interested above all in maintaining viewers so they can maintain their ratings, so they can have their advertising revenue, you can have an effect. Get three of your friends to do the same thing, and all of a sudden you'll notice that they will start listening. It may not be all that effective to write a letter to NBC News and Brian Williams, but your local news station is much more likely to listen to you, so you can exert that pressure close to home.
I think that's a pretty solid point. Michelle, do you have another question?
Well, can I give you the inside scoop out here in California?
You can.
Maybe you guys can help me with it.
You can, Michelle. Here's what I want to do. I'm afraid that our hour on the radio is up, but
sure.
I want you to stay tuned, because as you know, I have a significant web audience. You are one
right.
of those wonderful people out there who listens to me on the internet. I'm going to end the radio show. I'm sorry, radio folks. That's it for the Inside Scoop today. You can check in this Sunday, 6 p.m. I've got the Sunday Weekly Review. And this Sunday, we start new stations, San Diego, South Carolina, near Greenville, Orlando, Florida, and Cape Girardeau, Missouri are taking the Inside Scoop. We're going to welcome all those new listeners this Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern Time. I hope you'll check out the Inside Scoop. Then that is it for the radio show. Hang on one second, Michelle.
Sure.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop, or I should say the web-only Inside Scoop. That's it. It's just you and me on the computer now, folks. All those radio listeners, they are gone. But as you know, sometimes I do extend for web audience only. This is the perfect time to do it. I've got a great caller, Michelle. I've got a great guest, Paul Waldman, Senior Fellow of Media Matters. Can you stick around a little bit longer, Paul? Terrific. Michelle, you were telling us the situation in California. Go right ahead.
Well, you know, we are really trying to fight Arnold Schwarzenegger, put in by many like Karl Rove. I can't necessarily point directly to him, but I had met this guy, Dan Cox, who's doing this documentary, Running with Arnold, at a rally, 10,000 in Pershing Square last Wednesday. And he has been with Arnold, following Arnold and documenting him via, you know, video, and that is what his whole documentary is on, how Arnold got into the position he's at. And I think that if that information gets out to the public, you know, it helps them to understand the rhetoric and the propaganda that is out there and the disinformation.
Let me ask Paul this. Obviously, you're dealing with a very specific situation in California, and yet, of course, California is the largest American state. What is Media Matters doing, and if not Media Matters, other organizations around the country at the state level, even at the local level, to expose media bias, to tell the truth about Arnold Schwarzenegger, or frankly, anywhere else around the country where we've got, I mean, Spokane, Washington, you got
right.
the hypocritical, secretly gay guy who's anti-gay in his policies. What can you do, Media Matters, and if not you, what are others doing at the local and state level to expose media bias and expose hypocrisy?
Well, this has been a challenge for Media Matters because we are a Washington-based organization, and as you might imagine, it takes a long time to monitor Fox News and what happens on the other cable channels and on the regular news and newspapers and right-wing talk radio, and so we don't have the resources, unfortunately, unless we had the money to hire hundreds and hundreds hundreds of monitors to monitor things that are going on in every state and every city. So that's where people have to take an initiative and get involved and say, okay, I know that maybe there isn't a national organization that can do this for me. What can I do in my town? What if I and three of my friends who think this is important say, okay, you know, we're concerned about the media